Good day. Today is Tuesday, 21st October 2025. And let me remind you again, if once you've watched the video or watched that part of the video that you want to watch, you've liked the video, please do remember to tick the like button. Well, let's now get on to the details of this programme. And this is a further programme about the Ukrainian situation and about some recent statements. Let's start with some recent statements of the President of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky. Now, he's returned to Kiev following his trip to the United States, and he has made certain comments whilst he is in Ukraine, and they are interesting. Firstly, he has said that the Russians want the Ukrainians to withdraw completely from Donetsk and Lugansk, and he said that under no circumstances will Ukraine ever agree to that. He said that if Ukraine does agree to that, then it will lose its ability to shape its own future. It will no longer be involved in further discussions about its fate. And for that reason, he's not prepared to agree to do this. And that Ukraine will not, therefore, under any circumstances, withdraw from Donetsk and Lugansk. I should say that the Russians, in fact, are in almost total control of Lugansk. I understand that there are still some basically uninhabited territories in Lugansk, very small territories in Lugansk, which are still nominally under Ukrainian control. But all of Lugansk region effectively is under Russian control. As Donald Trump himself has pointed out, the Russians control 78% of Donetsk region. The Russians put it slightly higher at about 80%. We won't split hairs on the difference. The Ukrainians, however, do still retain control of what is for them an important positions in Donetsk region, the cities of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and Konstantinovka, and also the towns of Pokrovsk, Liman, and Siversk, all of which, of course, now are under extremely heavy pressure and which form Ukraine's major fortified line in Ukraine. A fact, by the way, that on the Duran we have pointed out for many years now, at least since the start of the special military operation, and which was also confirmed recently by the Institute for the Study of War, and which is also from time to time also admitted by sections of the Western media when briefly they actually discuss the realities of the war in a more objective way, something which, in my experience, they only very occasionally do. Anyway, so Zelensky is not prepared to withdraw from this territory. He is not prepared to withdraw from essentially Donetsk region. He's not prepared to surrender these towns, these fortified cities. And there is here, one must say this, some degree of military logic and indeed political logic in his doing so. Because even if the Russians were to stop their advance in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, if the Ukrainians do withdraw from Donetsk region, they will have surrendered their main defence line. And, well, as Simplicius the Thinker has today pointed out in his latest blog piece, if there is a ceasefire, if there is indeed a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, once the Ukrainians have evacuated their major defence line in Donbass, this line of cities, then in theory, if negotiations to settle the conflict prove unsuccessful, and the Russians decide to resume the war, then they will be able to advance without facing a major fortified line before them. So one can understand some of the logic in what Zelensky is saying. Zelensky, however, went on to say other things. He made the usual somewhat remarkable claims. He said that Ukraine is in the process of negotiating the buying of 25 Patriot air defense systems, which is a fantastic number, which he can only have plucked out of his imagination. There are no 25 Patriot missile systems that can be supplied to Ukraine, which are on offer. Supplying Ukraine with that number of Patriot missile systems would strip the West and much of the rest of the world of large sections of its air defense coverage. And the United States has made clear that that is not going to happen. But anyway, Zelensky then also, for the first time that I'm aware of, admitted that the Ukrainians are facing a very, very difficult situation in Pokrovsk. And we will return to that later in the program. However, Zelensky continued to speak optimistically about the military situation that the Ukrainians face. He spoke about how, despite the Russian pressure, despite the Russian advances, it is the Ukrainians who have the initiative. He spoke about the Ukrainian military being, as I understand it, a coiled spring. I believe that is the expression he used, that eventually, once the Russians have exhausted themselves, this coiled spring will go, shoot backwards, and hurl the Russians back, and Ukraine will recover all its lost territory and will win the war. So, I mean, he still speaks in this fantastic, extraordinary fashion. But anyway, he has made absolutely clear that he does not intend to withdraw from Donetsk and Lugansk region. He does not intend to withdraw from the Donbass, and that is not his intention. And I think that we should take this as fact. I have never known Zelensky to make concessions to the Russians over territory, to surrender territory to the Russians. This has always been something that he has resisted doing. And I cannot imagine this time that it is going to be any different. So when he says that he's not going to withdraw from Donbass, I think we should take that as his final answer. Now, the Financial Times yesterday published a further article, a follow-up article to its previous article, in which it spoke about the enormous row that took place on Friday between Donald Trump and Zelensky. It said that European governments were rallying to Zelensky's cause. And, well, we've had follow-up editorials, by the way, in the British media. And the editorials are interesting, and they're all the same. I've read at least two editorials which are almost exactly the same, and which I can summarise as follows, which is that the West European states, the Europeans, must now forget about any possibility that Donald Trump is going to arm Ukraine to the level that Ukraine would need to change the course of the war. They must forget about any idea that Donald Trump will ever impose sanctions and tariffs on Russia or on its major trading partners. None of this is ever going to happen. What the Europeans must instead do, supposedly, is finance and arm the Ukrainians themselves. They must take on the entire burden of the war upon themselves. I think it was the Daily Telegraph that entitled its editorial that assisting and arming Ukraine for Europe now is a moral duty. And there is no explanation, no comment anywhere, no indication in these editorials or in any of the articles about how this supposedly is going to be done, how the Europeans are going to be able to do this all by themselves. All of the editorials, all of the articles agree upon two things, that it's the moment has now come to expedite, to accelerate Ukraine's admission into the EU, how that is going to change the direction of the war, I am unable myself to see. And the other thing that the Europeans must do is that they must get on and hurry up in seizing the Russian frozen assets. This supposedly now is a moral priority. Put aside all of the legal concerns, all of the other concerns, put aside the effect that this might have on the credibility of Europe's financial system to the world beyond. Just seize these assets. It is a moral obligation to do it. And again, one of the editorials, I seem to remember it was the one in the Financial Times, said that these funds from these assets would by themselves suffice to arm Ukraine to the hilt so that it can withstand the Russians. Now, again, this is completely delusional because as I have been pointing out in program after program, extending all the way back to 2022, the limiting factor in arming Ukraine is not whether there is funds to do this. In the West, you can always find money to do this kind of thing. Donald Trump's administration is currently spending $20 to $40 billion, for example, on trying to support the Milei government in Argentina. In my opinion, this is good money thrown after bad. But the point is that the United States can find it. They can find money. The Europeans obviously are in a different position. They all face major budgetary problems. Britain and France are running big budget deficits. Germany has some more freedom here because its debt to GDP ratio is lower, but Germany is also frantically looking to rearm and to spend money, and perhaps there is money, less money in Europe around. But in the end, ultimately, if it was a question of finding money for Ukraine, the collective West could always find the way to do it. The problem is not money or the lack of it. The problem is weapons and the lack of those. As I've discussed in program after program, apparently Europe no longer builds tanks. I gather that the Leopard 2 and Challenger production lines are basically stopped. There is some plans in Germany to restart the Leopard 2 production line, but no word about that at the moment. The British are busy talking about placing in production a new tank, the Challenger 3, but there is no word at all of when that might happen. And the Challenger 3 is not on the horizon. It's not even been designed yet, though Brian Beletic, I think, correctly says that when it appears, it will be seen for what it is, another souped-up version of the Challenger 2. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all of that. Britain has managed to supply Ukraine, apparently, with all of its self-propelled guns. Denmark has done the same. I believe Germany has mostly done the same. Europe has stripped itself of its air defense missiles. I am not sure whether there is any production of fighter jets taking place across Europe, except in France. France does produce fighter jets, Rafales, but the order book for those apparently is filled. And I suspect that there is none of these to spare. And well, you get all kinds of completely different claims about ammunition production, shell production in Europe. But my own view is that some of the more optimistic claims about shell production in Europe have no connection to reality. And well, we have that recent article about the lack of high quality cotton fibers and of the impossibility to make shells, because without these cotton fibers, plants in Europe, factories in Europe cannot make the necessary high explosives. And in the United States, the situation is better, but not decisively better. The Americans also have struggled to get shell production up to the levels that they said they would. The new factory that they bought intact from Turkey, when I last saw just a few weeks ago, was still not in production. The United States doesn't apparently build Abrams tanks anymore. It refurbishes those it has. Apparently, and this is according to The Economist, it takes 2 years to refurbish a single tank in the United States. The United States does produce all sorts of other weapons, but we've seen that it has had problems with depleted inventories, air defense missile inventories, Tomahawk missiles. The inventory has not yet been tapped for Ukraine, but it is not so big that the United States is able, apparently, simply to part with these Tomahawk missiles in any big or significant quantities. So, overall, the United States is perhaps slightly better off in supplying weapons, but not that much more. And one of the most remarkable facts about the Ukraine war up to now is that neither the Europeans nor the Americans have so far managed to develop a drone production industry that can even remotely compare to the one that the Russians have, or which can supply drones on anything like the scale that the Russians are using in Ukraine today. So the problem is not money, it is the shortage of weapons. And even the money, if we're talking about the Russian assets, is not going to go anywhere near far enough. I read an article, again in the British media, which again spoke about a $140 billion euro loan, which is going to be basically secured against the Russian assets. And it pointed out that Ukraine, on average, spends around 80 billion euros a year on the war. And, well, at most, this loan might cover Ukraine for another year. And probably it won't be enough even for that. So, yes, there is money, and you can steal the assets or use the assets or come up with various schemes to use the financial assets. But the fundamental underlying problem is the sheer lack of military equipment and the ability of Western governments to organize the production to produce them. Now, Brian Baletic, in many programs that he has done on his invaluable YouTube channel, The New Atlas, has pointed out that in order to produce weapons in the kind of industrial quantities that would be needed to change the situation in Ukraine, the United States and the Europeans would need to carry out, in effect, a new industrial revolution, a complete overhaul from top to bottom of their entire industrial and economic structure. I noticed that on his equally invaluable Substack blog, the French commentator Arnaud Bertrand has made exactly the same point about production by the United States and the West of rare earths. He has focused on one specific rare earth metal and has pointed out that the fundamental problem in producing that particular metal, which is absolutely needed in parts of the US defense industry and at the higher end of the US electronics industry, the United States would need to completely rebuild from the bottom up its entire aluminium and aluminium smelting industry, because this particular metal is a byproduct of that industry. It would need to multiply production of aluminium, and it would need to find uses for all this additional aluminium that it was producing. And again, it would need to completely reorganize and revisit its whole industrial structure, not just its aluminium industry, in order to achieve that kind of outcome. And realistically, in any time frame, in any workable time frame, that isn't going to happen. Now, over the last couple of days, an article has appeared in the British newspaper, The Independent, written by Lord Richards, British Field Marshal, once the head of the British Army and indeed of the British military. Many people I know consider Lord Richards to be Britain's finest living army officer. He is somebody who has had a stellar reputation in terms of command. And he wrote a very interesting article in The Independent, which has not received anything like the attention in the wider British media that it deserves, and which these editorials in the British media about the Europeans needing to supply all the weapons and the support that Ukraine needs so that it can win the war, all of them basically ignore this. Lord Richards, first of all, said that Ukraine cannot win this war. He also said that there is no realistic possibility that Ukraine can recover its lost territory. But for me, the most important and interesting part of this article is that Lord Richards was specifically asked the question, if the West provides Ukraine with more weapons, will that make a difference to the course of the war? And Lord Richards replied straightforwardly, no. No, it cannot change the direction of the war. The Russians are too strong, their army is too big, it is too numerous, it is too well organized. He said that the only thing that might change the direction of the war is if the Western powers themselves directly intervened, if they joined the war themselves, if, in other words, they fought the Russians. He said that there is no realistic prospect of that happening, despite all of the claims, the wild talk about Russia posing a massive threat to Europe, of the Russians coming, of the need to defeat the Russians in Ukraine, because if we don't defeat them over there, we will have to fight them over here. I'm obviously embroidering a little what Lord Richards said. Anyway, despite all of that, the Western powers do not see the war in Ukraine as an existential issue for themselves, whereas the Russians do. And for that reason, the Western powers do not have the imperative to take the colossal risks of fighting the Russians in Ukraine. And for that reason, despite all of the break talk and all the indications to the contrary, they will never do so. So that brings us back to the realities of the conflict. Now, the Russians are advancing in Ukraine. There are lots of attempts to dispute and disregard and ignore this. There continues to be the narrative out there that the war is in stalemate, that the Russian offensive that has been taking place throughout 2025 has been unsuccessful. By the way, I noticed that every single commentary that makes that claim disregards entirely the catastrophic defeat the Ukrainians suffered in March in Kursk region. That episode has now been practically deleted from the commentary. We always have to talk about the stalemate that exists on the battlefronts now. But as I have discussed in many, many programs, yes, this is a grinding attrition war. Russian advances are indeed incremental, but there is not and has not been, indeed there has never been at any time in this war, anything that could remotely be called a stalemate. There have been pauses, there have been moments when the two sides have taken stock, there have been ebbs and flows, but certainly since October 2023, when the Russians conclusively defeated Ukraine's 2023 summer counteroffensive, the Russians have held the initiative and have been continuously advancing. Now, given that this is so, given that this is the reality, that the Russians are advancing, given what even people like Lord Richards are saying, that there is no weapon system or quantities of weapon systems, that the West is capable of supplying that can change the balance of the war. Given that even seizing the Russian assets, which, by the way, I consider a given, is only going to provide a certain amount of money, which Ukraine will burn through incredibly fast. Given that all of this is the case, why do we continue this pretense that in Europe we're in a position to change the situation in Ukraine, the military situation in Ukraine, that we have a moral duty to support Ukraine, when the reality is that if we do have such a duty, which, by the way, I strongly dispute, we are not in a position to fulfill or discharge that duty. Now, I say all of this because I go back to the Financial Times article. All of the European governments are now supporting Zelensky in his opposition to the Russian demands to withdraw from Donbass, demands that were supposedly, in fact, I have no doubt that they were, repeated to Zelensky by Donald Trump during this very tense and acrimonious meeting that took place on Friday. Now, here at this point, I'm going to say something which I need to say in correction of my programme of yesterday. I said that there'd be no denial by the United States of the accounts that appeared in the Financial Times and elsewhere about the heated nature of the meeting between Zelensky and Trump. I also said that though Zelensky claimed that the United States, that Trump had agreed that the conflict needed to be frozen, that the ceasefire needed to take place on the existing on the existing conflict lines. The Americans did not seem to be confirming this. Well, as is so often the case, there is such an overload of information in this conflict that I missed a brief set of comments made by Donald Trump himself, which he made to camera. And over the course of them, Donald Trump denied that the topic of land swaps between Russia and Ukraine had been discussed. This idea that the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass and in return the Russians return to Ukraine territory, perhaps in Kharkiv region, but maybe also in Zaporozhye and Kherson region as well. Donald Trump denied that that had been discussed and said that the American position was that the fighting should stop on the existing conflict line. Now, I have, and that everything else, all of the other contentious matters, should be discussed thereafter. Now, I don't believe Donald Trump when he says this, I would point out that in the case of Donald Trump, we're talking about an individual who has recently made up a whole conversation with Prime Minister Modi of India, which apparently never took place. A telephone call in which Prime Minister Modi supposedly assured President Trump that India was going to reduce its purchases of Russian oil. The Indian authorities apparently have now clearly said that not only was that assurance never given, but that there was never a call of that kind between Modi and Trump. Well, if so, that basically shows that what Trump says on these sort of matters is not to be taken seriously. And, well, saying, of course, that one shouldn't trust what Donald Trump says, I think that's not going to be controversial with many people. Anyway, but beyond that, there are reasons why Trump would not want to discuss this whole topic of land swaps and that kind of thing in public. As far as I'm aware, the official American position continues to be that the fighting should indeed stop on the existing conflict lines. There may have been discussions, private discussions between the Americans and the Russians that talked about other things. But I can understand why the President of the United States doesn't really want to make those kind of discussions public, especially in advance of a summit meeting with Vladimir Putin, which is going to take place in a few weeks' time. Bear in mind that if there have been any discussions about land swaps, about the Ukrainians pulling out of Donbass and the Russians stopping in Zaporozhye and Kherson region and returning some territory to the Ukraine, if there have been those discussions, the Russians publicly have not confirmed their existence either. So perhaps it is unsurprising that the President of the United States is not willing to make that disclosure public as well. Anyway, I have no doubt that the Financial Times and the media reports are true. And it seems to me that Zelensky's own comments about the Russians wanting Ukraine to withdraw from Donbass, Donetsk and Lugansk regions essentially confirmed that the reports are true. That Trump did indeed tell Zelensky that the Russians are insisting that Ukraine withdraw from Donetsk and Lugansk, that they are prepared to contemplate ceasefires in other places, temporary ceasefires, probably, as Simplicius the Thinker and others say. Possibly land swaps as well. But the fundamental condition must be a withdrawal by Ukraine from Donetsk and Luhansk regions. I've no doubt that that is what Trump said, and that Trump also told Zelensky that there will not be Tomahawk missiles, and that if Ukraine refused this Russian offer, or this Russian proposal, or this Russian agreement to what might have been originally an American proposal, then the result would be ultimately a continuation of the war and the eventual destruction of Ukraine. And by the way, on that topic, perhaps it's worth pointing out that if Putin really did tell Trump over the course of their telephone conversation on Thursday that if the Ukrainians didn't accept this idea, if they didn't agree to withdraw from Donbass, and that the war as a result continued, that the effect would be the eventual destruction of Ukraine, well, then in that case, it's perhaps worth adding that what Putin actually gave Trump when they spoke on Thursday was a kind of ultimatum to be passed on to the Ukrainians. Withdraw from Donbass or face complete destruction. Just say, of course, to repeat again, I wasn't listening in on Trump's and Putin's call. I wasn't listening in. I wasn't party to Trump's and Zelensky's conversations. I have to rely on third-party reports of what took place over the course of those conversations, though I believe that these reports are true. And as I said, it seems to me that Zelensky essentially is corroborating them. So anyway, there we are. Zelensky refusing the Russian ultimatum. And it would be an ultimatum. And we will see why shortly. Zelensky rejecting the Russian ultimatum. At the same time that the Russians are pushing hard in Pokrovsk, as he himself admits, and at the same time as people like Lord Richards, who must be considered an expert in this matter, are saying that the war is in effect lost. There is nothing the Western powers can do to change the military situation on the battlefield. It's something, by the way, that on the Duran and in these programs we have been saying for a long time now. It's been said by many others. I mentioned Brian Beletic, but you could argue that others have been saying it as well. But anyway, this is Lord Richards this time. And perhaps, given who he is, that ought to carry weight. That ought to carry special weight. Anyway, that brings me back to the Europeans. Surely, in light of these realities, in light of the fact that Putin appears to have presented Trump, but ultimately Zelensky and Ukraine with an ultimatum, in light of the military realities, in light of the financial realities, you would have thought that instead of talking about moral duties to arm Ukraine, something that cannot be done, and which Lord Richards is saying is not going to make any difference, instead of talking in this way, instead of still talking about Tomahawk missiles, which even military experts consulted by the Financial Times have acknowledged would not be a game changer, Western governments, European governments, would be lending their support to Donald Trump, telling Zelensky, the game is up. You can't go on with this war anymore. We lack the means to help you. The Americans, it seems, are short of those means as well. The Russians are still prepared to cut a deal, but they've now presented you with an ultimatum. If you reject it, the outcome could very well be the destruction of your country. So accept that ultimatum and settle now. That, it seems to me, would be the wise, correct, prudent, and by the way, moral course for the Europeans to take. I say moral course because the alternative threatens the destruction of Ukraine, whilst what is being proposed would possibly, in some form at least, ensure its continued existence. The Europeans, according to the Financial Times, are doing the opposite. They're telling Zelensky, ignore the Russian ultimatum, ignore what Trump is telling you, just keep on fighting. We now understand that Donald Trump is never going to impose massive sanctions and tariffs against the Russians. By the way, Senator Thune, the Senate Majority Leader for the Republicans, it has now confirmed that the Senate is not going to give further consideration to Lindsey Graham's and Richard Blumenthal's bone-crushing sanctions bill until the summit meeting between Putin and Trump has taken place, whenever that is. I don't myself take this bill seriously anymore, for all kinds of reasons which by now ought to be obvious. Anyway, forget about sanctions, forget about arms deliveries. The reality is, and by the way, there's been lots of articles, especially in the Swiss and German media, which concede that, in fact, despite all of the brave talk, arms deliveries from the West to Ukraine are reducing. They're not reducing because the Americans and the Europeans don't want to send arms to Ukraine. If we were talking about the United States of the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s able to produce weapons in unlimited quantities, if the same was true in Europe, of course they would be sending arms to Ukraine. The reason they are not sending arms to Ukraine in the quantities that they did before is that their stockpiles have dwindled and production is not keeping up with demand, either their own demand or the demand, of course, of Ukraine itself. So the Europeans ought to be telling Zelensky, we can't provide you with the weapons you need. We can't provide you with the money you need. Yes, we might do this terrible thing, seize the Russian assets or come up with some scheme which we can present as not seizing the Russian assets, but actually doing so. But that will only provide you with a temporary relief. It's like what President Kennedy once said about American aid to South Vietnam. It's a glass of water. You drink it and then the effect wears off and you need another. It's the same with endless transfers of funds to Ukraine. For a short time, it tides the Ukrainians over, but then the effect wears off and they need more money still. and they ultimately always come back for more. So we can't give you the money. We can't change the economic realities, especially now that the Russians are every night now striking Ukraine, hammering away at you with missiles and drones and all of those things. We can't give you weapons. The Americans can't give you weapons. So make the deal. Accept the proposal, the ultimatum the Russians are making. It hasn't yet been made public. We can dress it up if you like. We can spin it in some way if you accept it. And then at least you might have a chance to survive. It is incredible. It is beyond baffling. It is beyond any rational computation that that is not what the Europeans are doing. Even if you accept the argument, which I make many times, that the reason the Europeans want to keep the Ukraine war going is because they want to keep the United States in Europe. They want to keep the American commitment to NATO and the EU alive, because they sense that if the Americans go, those institutions will start to flag and perhaps in time crumble, and that they need the spectre of the Russian bear on the prowl to persuade the Americans to stay. Even if you accept that argument, and it is my argument, so I do accept it, then it still doesn't make sense. Is it really better for Europe that Ukraine be destroyed and that there be a clear-cut defeat of Europe in Ukraine, of Europe and the West in Ukraine, than that some kind of Ukraine is assisted to survive this war? I would have thought not. After all, I think it was Donald Tusk who recently said a defeat for Europe in a defeat for Ukraine is a defeat for Europe. If that is true, of a limited defeat in Ukraine, how much truer must it be of a total one? I've said many times, in many places, that the quality of political leadership in Europe is the worst, not just in living memory, but quite possibly that there has ever been. I remember, I read recently an article in which Henry Kissinger, apparently, you know, shortly before he died, apparently made exactly the same point to an Asian leader, that the people that he was meeting in Europe, the leaders that he was meeting in Europe, were the most pathetic bunch of non-entities that he had ever encountered. Anyway, there it is. I mean, you have the proof. And of course, the Russians, for their part, continue their advance. And well, before talking about that, I will say that Lavrov and Rubio yesterday had their call. Both the Russian and American foreign ministries, the State Department and the Russian foreign ministry, have provided brief readouts. The readouts are very brief. They say that the calls were constructive. Presumably there's going to be a meeting between these two at some point. Peskov yesterday was saying that neither the location of the meeting between Rubio and Lavrov nor the agenda had at that time been fully sorted out, but work on preparing it was ongoing, and I expect that the process was taken further over the course of this call. So work to set up the summit is underway. I notice that there are still some people who have doubts that the summit will take place. I think it is all but inconceivable that it won't. I'm sure that Trump and Putin are going to meet. And I am also sure that that meeting will take place in Budapest. The Bulgarian government has now apparently confirmed that it will give Russia, give Putin overflight rights, so that it will guarantee that if Putin's aircraft flies through Bulgarian airspace on its way to Budapest, the Bulgarians will not interfere with it. So my own view is that this meeting is indeed going to happen, and that work to prepare it is underway. What the two leaders are going to discuss is an entirely different matter. Whether Trump is going to tell Putin that he personally supports and endorses this plan, assuming, by the way, it exists. Just to say, I mean, there's still been no public confirmation on any side about it, that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass and there is a ceasefire in all other respects, and that there should be a quick push towards sorting out all of the other issues. Again, I want to stress, I'm far from certain that this is the case, but let's assume that that is true. Maybe Trump and Putin will meet, and Trump will tell Putin that this is now what Trump supports, that he understands that Ukraine is going to lose Donbass, and he's going to use all of the influence that the United States can bring to bear to get the Ukrainians and presumably the Europeans to agree to that. Well, maybe that is what one of the things that they will talk about. Perhaps they will talk about other things, about economic cooperation, security cooperation, the START Treaty, and all of those other questions. But anyway, I'm not going to discuss the summit meeting anymore. But anyway, the point is that whatever Putin and Trump perhaps might agree between them, we see that Zelensky himself is now clearly taking a stand. It is no compromise, and the Europeans incredibly are supporting him in this. Now, either one of two things happens in light of this. Either Trump walks away if the Europeans and the Ukrainians refuse, and the Russians do go forward and destroy Ukraine, or Trump finally has that showdown with the Europeans and with the hardliners in his own administration that he has for the last 8 months consistently avoided. The third possibility, which is that Putin will capitulate and agree to a freeze of the conflict, which is what the Europeans and the Ukrainians are demanding, in my opinion, simply does not exist. But one way or the other, this is high noon. At least this is my own clear view. The Russians appear now to have given something which could be described as an ultimatum. I don't believe that Putin is going to back off from it. We will see what happens over the next few weeks. But so far, there is little sign that Trump is prepared to put the pressure on the Europeans and the Ukrainians to get them to agree. And given the kind of commentaries and the language that is coming out of Europe, and given the extraordinary statements that continue to be made by people like Kaya Kallas and some German officials, the Germans are still talking about how Hungary has an obligation to arrest Putin if he comes to Budapest, which, I mean, it seems to me so completely delusional to be saying at this time that, again, I do wonder the connection to reality of these people. Anyway, I cannot imagine that the Europeans will willingly back off their support for this intransigent position that Zelensky is taking. And I'm not sure that they will change their stance even if Trump tells them that they must change their stance on this. I can see how the Europeans might pretend to themselves that they can go all the way by themselves without the United States buying, I suppose, whatever weapons they can afford from the Americans from time to time, which they will quickly find they can no longer do. I'm not sure what pressure the United States can bring to bear upon them, which is going to make them change their stance. But at any rate, for the moment, they show no interest or desire to do so. In the meantime, the Russians continue to advance in Ukraine. And can I say, first of all, that there was a truly horrible article today. There is still a truly horrible article today in the Daily Telegraph, which speaks gloatingly about Ukrainian attack, destruction of a boat on the Dnieper River with drones carrying Russian soldiers. There is far too much of this, frankly, ghoulish type of commentary, gloating commentary, especially in the British media. And I wish it would stop. But the point is, and this is perhaps something that one ought to take into account, the fact that the Ukrainians are indeed publishing drone footage of Russian boats with soldiers on board in the Dnieper does perhaps provide some further credence to the claims that the Russians have indeed now established a foothold across the Dnieper in the city of Kherson. But maybe the most dramatic news comes from Pokrovsk. And notice that even Zelensky now is admitting for the first time that the Ukrainians are facing what he calls a difficult situation in Pokrovsk. When Zelensky talks about a difficult situation for the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk, what, of course, he really means is that the Ukrainians are facing a crisis in Pokrovsk. Yesterday, Radovka provided further information about the situation in Pokrovsk, and it is very detailed. Again, somebody is providing Ukraine with providing Radovka with detailed information about the battle in Pokrovsk. I have to assume that it is coming from the Russian military itself, from the general staff, perhaps from the command of a group of forces center, because it is so detailed that I have little doubt that it is true. And as I pointed out in many programs, Radovka has been consistently correct in the articles, in its articles, in which it has discussed the Battle of Pokrovsk and the fighting northeast of Pokrovsk, which has been taking place over the last 2 months. And what Radovka says is that the Russians have indeed basically crossed the railways, and that they have indeed encircled pockets of Ukrainian troops in several parts of Pokrovsk itself. In several places, there are what Radovka says are in effect merely mini cauldrons that Ukrainian soldiers are now trapped in certain high-rise buildings encircled on all sides by the Russians. And the picture that Radovka is providing is of a completely catastrophic situation, of essentially Pokrovsk overall having fallen, and of the Russians in the process now of clearing remnants of Ukrainian defenders isolated from each other in fragments in different parts of Pokrovsk. Now, Radovka and various other Russian commentaries and channels are also claiming that the village of Rodinska, actually it's more than a village, it's a small town, the small town of Rodinska, immediately to the north of Pokrovsk, has either entirely fallen under Russian control or is about to do so. And it's been suggested that with the fall of Rodinska, the remaining gaps in the ring around Pokrovsk will have closed, that the cauldron in which the Ukrainian troops are trapped within in Pokrovsk will have been sealed shut. Well, again, let me say it once more. I am not on the ground. I am not in a position myself to speak with full authority about what is going on in Pokrovsk. I am reliant upon the same reporting channels that all of the other commentators are. But I can express my own views. It does seem to me that we are now in the last days of the Battle of Pokrovsk. It is very similar to the situation that I remember in Avdiivka in about a week or 2 weeks before Avdiivka's fall, in which groups of Ukrainian troops had been surrounded and trapped defending positions in Avdiivka. Other Ukrainian troops were conducting a disorganized retreat from Avdiivka into the fields, trying to escape to the Ukrainian-controlled villages to the north. It took a certain amount of time for the battle, the mopping up operation in Avdiivka, to be completed, but it was completed and it became clear that the Ukrainians had suffered not just a defeat but a major disaster in Avdiivka. And as I said, the reports are similar of chaotic retreats by Ukrainian soldiers from southern Pokrovsk across the railways into northern Pokrovsk, of isolated pockets of Ukrainians resisting in various places, unable to retreat, unwilling to surrender, uncertain what to do, of the Russians tightening their control all the time. And that we've not yet had reports of Ukrainian soldiers trying to escape across the fields, northwards, ultimately towards Dobropilia. I suspect a lot of that probably is already happening. It's just that we're not getting the reports about it. Bear in mind that Pokrovsk and nearby Mirnograd are much bigger, several times bigger than Avdiivka is, so that a collapse in Pokrovsk inevitably is going to be a more complex and longer affair than the collapse of Avdiivka was. So we might still have some time to go, though I know some people are counting the time in days, perhaps weeks is more realistic. To repeat again what I have already said, the fall of Pokrovsk, when it happens, is going to be the single biggest defeat for Ukraine in the war. It is going to undermine the entire integrity of Ukraine's remaining defense line in Donbass. It is impossible to see how Ukraine will be able to defend Konstantinovka, the next big town lying to the east for very long once Pokrovsk falls, and once Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka have fallen, and once Kupiansk, Liman, and Siversk have also fallen in the north, then that will leave only two places that the Ukrainians still control in Donbass, Slavyansk, and Kramatorsk. And the geography points to those two places at that point being effectively encircled. Now, in relation to the fighting in Slavyansk, sorry, in the Slavyansk area, in Liman and Siversk, reports have also started to appear that the Ukrainian forces in this area are also, in effect, finding themselves in a developing cauldron, that they are being pressed by the Russians, basically against the various rivers there, and that their lines of retreat are also being cut. It does seem as if, for the first time since 2022, the Russians are not only seeking to capture cities, but that they are aiming to surround and destroy whole Ukrainian military forces on the ground. They're no longer providing lines of retreat as they were doing for the Ukrainians in towns like Selidovo, Kurakhovo, and other places last year. And that reinforces my view that it's not just a case of the Russians wanting to break the last big remaining Ukrainian defense line. What even the Institute for the Study of War acknowledges is Ukraine's main defense line, the one which, if it falls, would allow the Russians to advance to the Dnieper and perhaps to threaten Kiev itself. It is that the Russians also are now working towards destroying the Ukrainian army in the field, together with that defense line. Anyway, all of this is my assessments. Events might show that things are more complicated than they seem. But even Zelensky, to repeat now, is admitting that the situation in Pokrovsk is difficult. Lord Richards is saying that there is nothing the West can do to retrieve the military situation in Ukraine, no weapons deliveries that the West can provide that are going to change the situation. And of course, and in addition, we also have other reports about deteriorating problems for Ukraine. And as I've discussed already, there is no real prospect of funding and military supplies being provided, no Tomahawk missiles being provided that could even notionally change the situation in any way. So, possibly, probably, a Russian ultimatum. We will see whether in the next few weeks, between now and the Budapest summit, reality finally dawns in Kiev and in the West, at least in Europe. To be clear, I don't believe it will. And beyond that, based on what Donald Trump is saying, if it doesn't, well, we're talking now about the probable destruction of Ukraine. I know that is what meant some people, including some people who watch these programs, won't want to see happen. I am not one of those people, but it could be that their wish is going to come to pass. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.